Broadcasting on the Drug Truth Network, this is Cultural Baggage.
It's not only inhumane, it is really fundamentally un-American.
My name is Dean Becker. I don't condone or encourage the use of any drugs, legal or illegal. I report the unvarnished truth about the pharmaceutical, banking, prison, and judicial nightmare that feeds on eternal drug war. It's good to have you with us on this edition of Cultural Baggage. We'll be hearing from many of our Drug Truth Network reporters. We're also going to hear about my forthcoming trip to Bolivia on behalf of the Drug Truth Network. We'll hear from Mr. Michael Joseph, who speaks for Witness for Peace, the group I'm going with. We'll also hear a little bit from Chris Crane about the forthcoming conference in Washington, D.C., on behalf of Students for Sensible Drug Policy. But to kick off today's show, I want to start with a report from a gentleman I'm quite proud joins us pretty much on a weekly basis. He spent 32 years working for the U.S. government as a Customs, Border, and Air Interdiction Officer. He retired last year as a GS-14, the equivalent of a bird colonel.
This is Terry Nelson speaking on behalf of LEAP, Law Enforcement Against Prohibition, Priorities. It should be apparent we will never arrest our way out of the drug war. However, we can treat our drug problem with education and medical treatment instead of incarceration. Our police should be focusing all their efforts on solving crimes against people, places, or things, and not chasing after nonviolent offenders. The DEA, a well-trained and funded investigative branch, should really be working against America's real enemies and not its citizens. Keep in mind that in 1913, there was not an illegal drug in this country, and we had approximately 1.3% of the population addicted to drugs. The Harrison Drug Act of 1914 was the beginning of illegal drugs. In 1972, when the war on drugs started, we had an estimated 1.3% of the population addicted. And the estimate is the same today, 1.3%. It's all about priorities. In the business sector, goals are set, plans developed, and results are expected. Let's assume that the goal is to win the war on drugs. If the plan does not deliver the intended results in a reasonable amount of time, say 5 years, the plan must be changed, right? I suspect that if the DEA was a private company, it would be bankrupt. More than three times its original staffing size, the DEA's budget is more than 28 times the original budget. Results? Statistics indicate more arrests each year, but no drop in availability of drugs. In fact, quite the opposite. Drugs are more available, higher purity, and easier to get than 30 years ago. Any logical measurement indicates that this is a losing effort, and that the vast sums of money, some estimate as high as $100 billion annually, and more than a trillion since DEA's inception, are being wasted implementing the failed public policy of prohibition. According to data on the DEA website comparing 1986 with 2005, arrests for agents are down, costs per arrest are up. Nonviolent marijuana offenders incarcerated account for 81% of the people arrested, and in the past 5 years, there are almost twice as many meth lab incidents. Even though more and more resources are added each year, the drugs and associated violence increase annually. Dr. Milton Friedman, Nobel laureate, in an October interview indicated that as many as 10,000 deaths annually can be attributed to the war on drugs. A change of priorities is needed. We as a nation must develop an alternative strategy to deal with our drug problem. LEAP believes in a two-pronged approach. Legalize drugs, regulate the quality, and control their distribution. Spend funds on education and treatment. Dr. Friedman further stated in an open letter to President Bush that revenue from taxation of marijuana sales would range from $2.4 billion per year if marijuana were taxed like ordinary consumer goods to $6.2 billion if it were taxed like alcohol or tobacco. A program, the War on Drugs, with a stated goal of reducing crime, drug addiction, and juvenile drug use, has done the exact opposite. It's time for a change. Let's work together for a better future for ourselves and our children. This is Terry Nelson at www.leap.cc signing off.
Again, you see why I'm proud. Thanks, Terry, for that report. I want to say something. Last week it was reported that in Virginia, last week a federal indictment was handed down in Virginia where a sheriff was caught covering up a scheme in which a dozen of his deputies sold seized guns and drugs to the public. It names Henry County Sheriff Harold Franklin Castle and 19 others. All but two of those indicted were taken into custody this past week. The charges include racketeering conspiracy, weapons offenses, narcotics distribution, obstruction of justice,
and perjury. Quote, it is disgraceful corruption, end quote, so said U.S. Attorney John Lee Brownlee, whose words you hear next, thanks to the good folks at CNN.
This week, a federal grand jury for the Western District of Virginia returned a 48-count indictment charging 20 individuals, including 13 current and former members of the Henry County Sheriff's Office, a former probation officer for Henry County, and a former employee of the United States Postal Service, with multiple violations of federal law, including racketeering, illegal narcotics trafficking, theft of firearms, possession of stolen firearms, money laundering, making false statements, perjury, and obstruction of justice. The grand jury has returned a speaking indictment which details specific conduct alleged by the grand jury. I'd like to take a few moments to discuss the history of the investigation and the indictment. According to the 48-count indictment, since 1998, sworn officers, employees, and associates of Henry County Sheriff's Office engaged in a continuous scheme to steal illegal drugs, firearms, and contraband from the seized evidence property room. The defendants took cocaine, crack cocaine, marijuana, and firearms, and then sold the stolen drugs and guns back into our community. The grand jury has also alleged that several of the defendants stole seized firearms and other contraband for their own personal use. The grand jury has alleged that seven of the charged defendants, including four former Henry County deputies, conspired to commit multiple acts of racketeering. The grand jury has alleged that six of the defendants, including four former deputies, conspired to illegally distribute ketamine and steroids. In addition, Carlton Riley, a former probation officer for Henry County, has been charged with illegally participating in a cocaine deal. The grand jury has alleged that 13 of the defendants, including eight current and former members of the Henry County Sheriff's Office, lied to federal agents and to the grand jury, encouraged others to lie to federal agents and to the grand jury, and obstructed the investigation.
Now, we don't have the corrupt cop story of the week from Phil Smith this week, but we do have evidence of that corrupt cop. You know, he's out there. These guys have been doing this for 8 years. Perhaps they did it without any investigation for seven. The government spends $70 to $200 billion a year to run this drug war, hand it over to the criminal justice system, the prison industrial complex, if you will. And according to the UN, worldwide, people give $400 to $500 billion each year to the terrorists, to the criminals, to the violent gangs, to the street corner vendors selling drugs to our kids, to purchase our recreational drugs. A large portion of that $400 to $500 billion is used as bribe money to bribe guards and customs agents and cops and judges and district attorneys. It happens every day. Why? Because that's how we like it, I suppose. In the main, drugs are cheaper, purer, and more freely available to our children than ever before, thanks to drug prohibition. This result has come about despite decades of waging this drug war. Why do you suppose that is? Could it be the fact that they get, I don't know, $100 billion to wage this war every year, plus whatever they can garner by forfeiture statutes, and whatever they can get through the corruption process? Again, 8 years these guys have been doing this. How many other police forces out there are doing this but are just smarter and better able to cover up their foibles along the way? Remember, the criminals have a $500 billion income each year with which to make those payoffs to keep the drugs flowing. As I mentioned earlier, I am next week going to Bolivia, going to tour the coca fields, going to Santa Cruz and to La Paz, and visit with a lot of NGOs and government officials along the way, both as a reporter and as a spokesman for law enforcement against prohibition. I hope to recruit some additional law enforcement personnel from Bolivia. Next up, we'll hear from one of the, in essence, tour guides, experts that'll help us on this trip.
I'm Michael Joseph, and I work for an organization called Peace Brigades International that sends international volunteers into countries in conflict to protect in a nonviolent way activists who are at risk in those countries because of their work. But I'm here mostly today to talk about my work with Witness for Peace, which is an organization that works to change U.S. foreign policy towards Latin America. And I'm on the board of directors of Witness for Peace currently, and served in the past on the Nicaragua team, the Cuba team, and the Colombia team of Witness for Peace for a total of about 4.5 years.
We are scheduled to go here in just 1 week from the date of this recording, headed towards Bolivia as part of a group of Witness for Peace members. And tell us what this trip is about, what we're likely to encounter along the way.
Sure. Well, we want to, you know, largely look at the impact of U.S. foreign policy in Bolivia. We're going to visit a number of different areas in Bolivia. There are a lot of different, you know, factions. There are a lot of different political ideologies currently in Bolivia. And there's a lot of change that's underfoot in Bolivia. So we want to try and get a scope of what's happening in the country, so that we can come back to the United States and be more informed about the reality of what's actually happening in Bolivia, to be able to engage with our political processes here in the United States.
Other than a couple of smuggling runs in my youth, I've hardly been out of the U.S., but I was wondering if you could tell me your perceptions. I mean, you know, there's talk about Uribe in Colombia and the gentleman from Venezuela.
Chavez.
Chavez talking about Bush leaving a sulfur smell there in the U.N. And then we have Mr. Evo Morales, a former coca grower, who's now the president of Bolivia and who wants to destigmatize the use of the coca plant, which is used widespread, is in fact legal in Bolivia, is it not?
Absolutely, yes. It's a legal and a commonly used product in Bolivia. The indigenous community in Bolivia has used the coca leaf as part of their diet, mostly by chewing on it. For, you know, centuries and centuries, it's been just a very common part of their culture and their practice there. And now currently it also has a number of different types of uses. It's used in teas and toothpaste and has a number of medicinal uses as well, but all sorts of sort of modern products that include use of the coca leaf.
Well, I know.
All of which, of course, have a non, you know, absolutely non-narcotic effect of any type. It does include, it is a mild stimulant, sort of akin to caffeine or something like that, but without the addictive properties that something like caffeine would have.
Now, I know that, as you say, it's widely used and in its natural form is not a health threat. I think it's only through the policy of prohibition, the need to compact the amount that they're shipping, that they create these more powerful drugs and ship them to the U.S. and other countries and create the violence and the disturbance within society. Your thoughts, sir, the international perspective on the United States.
Sure. I mean, you know, for the average person who's growing coca in the Andes, be it in Bolivia or Peru or Colombia, the average farmer, these are small peasant farmers who are simply trying to make a living. And in fact, they're not the ones that are changing this leaf into a product that becomes a narcotic product in the United States. In fact, they have very little sense of what it's even, you know, how that process even works or what it's being used for. They're simply being told, you know, here's a product that I can grow relatively easily. In Bolivia, it's a product that, you know, my family and my ancestors have grown for thousands of years. It's been a positive, healthy part of our diet for thousands of years. And somebody wants to buy it from me at a fair price, at a price that, you know, perhaps my family can eke out an existence on in ways that we couldn't with other products. And so, of course, you know, the law of supply and demand there says that as long as there's a demand for this product, you know, people are going to be willing to grow it. And so that's certainly what happens. And, of course, it then is a big shock or a surprise to find out all of a sudden someone in the United States, politicians, have decided that this product should be illegal. It should not be grown anymore and should be forcibly eradicated, either by soldiers coming in to uproot it or by spray planes coming through the sky to drop down pest herbicides on the plant and kill it. It's very hard to understand or really make sense of from that perspective.
Once again, we're speaking with Mr. Michael Josephs of many organizations, apparently, but we're talking about Witness for Peace, our forthcoming trip to Bolivia. Now, you've given us a bit of your history, a summary of mine. I am a member of Law Enforcement Against Prohibition, a radio and television reporter. Who else is going to be going on this trip with us?
Well, there are a number of different folks. I don't actually know all of them, but Joanne Rainey is one of the organizers of the trip. She's one of the regional organizers for Witness for Peace, which is a grassroots organization. So she works with our grassroots region up in the New England region. Another of the organizers is San Ho Tree of the Drug Policy Project at the Institute for Policy Studies, one of the experts on the drug war in the United States. And really it was the three of us that kind of came together to get this delegation off the ground and, felt like it was an important moment to go to Bolivia at this time and take a look at both what's happening internally in Bolivia and to look at what our U.S. Foreign policies are doing there as well.
Well, we're going to be leaving the day after the U.S. elections. There's the old book and the old analogy about the ugly American. Let's hope these elections allow us to be received with some sort of embrace.
Absolutely. I hope so. And, we certainly want to do what we can to reverse that adage of the ugly American and actually be hopefully intelligent and compassionate and engaged Americans that seek a U.S. foreign policy that's based much more on compassion and intelligence than our current policies are.
Well, Michael, if you would share the website of Witness for Peace and any other organizations you think folks could learn from.
Sure. You can check out Witness for Peace at www.witnessforpeace.org, all spelled out, all three words, witnessforpeace.org, doing fantastic work all throughout the Americas, and also the organization I work for as well, which is Peace Brigades International, as well, www.peacebrigades.org.
Hey, look, you know, the main thing I hope to accomplish from this trip is to come back alive. I have some fear and trepidations about this, stepping outside the bounds and the reach of my friends within law enforcement against prohibition, outside the purview of the great defense attorneys that stand in my support. But for the Drug Truth Network, I think anything I can do to expose this giant fraud of prohibition will prove to be of great worth. Immediately upon my return to the U.S., I land in Miami and I fly not back to Houston, but to Washington, D.C., to attend the first International Conference of Students for Sensible Drug Policy.
My name is Chris Crane. I'm the Executive Director of Students for Sensible Drug Policy.
Chris, you guys have worked very hard over the years to try to repeal this provision, which prevents students from getting grant money from the government, from getting assistance towards their education, and there was a bit of a setback of late. Tell us about that.
Well, yeah, we've been working basically since our inception in 1998 to repeal the Higher Education Act aid elimination penalty, which is a law that denies federal financial aid to any student with a drug conviction. We did have a victory on that earlier this year when Congress agreed to scale the law back, making it so that the law now only applies to students who are receiving aid at the time of their conviction. It used to be that if you had a conviction on your record at any point in your history, you would automatically be denied aid the first time you applied for it. Under the new rules, it only applies to students who are receiving aid at the time of their convictions. However, in our attempts to repeal the law outright, we filed a lawsuit in federal court with pro bono legal representation from the ACLU Drug Law Reform Project. In this lawsuit, we challenged the constitutionality of the aid elimination penalty. This lawsuit was filed a few months ago, and unfortunately, just last Friday afternoon, the federal judge in this case granted the government's motion to dismiss the lawsuit. So Unfortunately, with that dismissal, the suit has been basically thrown out of court for now, unless we decide that we're going to appeal this ruling.
And if I recall, the judge even indicated that there was some sort of imbalance there, but not necessarily unconstitutionally so. Your thoughts on that?
That's correct. What the judge said was that he acknowledged that it is unfair that this law only applies to students with drug convictions, whereas rapists and murderers and violent criminals do not face the removal of financial aid as a result of those convictions. However, he did state that just because the law is unfair does not mean it's unconstitutional. Now, obviously, at SSDP and at the ACLU, we all disagree strongly with the ruling. We feel that this law is unconstitutional, but unfortunately, the judge did not see it that way.
Well, certain of the U.S. Supreme Court justices have talked about the drug war exception to the Constitution, and this would seem to kind of parallel that thought. Let me ask you this. Murderers, rapists, and violent criminals can still get these government funds, and yet if you're caught with a little bag of marijuana, you can't get it. That's right?
That's absolutely correct. The way the law stands, if you were convicted of a drug offense, and it's any drug offense, even if it's possession of a small amount of marijuana, you will automatically lose your federal financial aid for at least 1 year, what the exact drug crime is, and how many offenses you have on your record. However, the federal government cannot ask you whether you have a conviction on your record for any crimes other than a drug crime. So if you're convicted of assault, or you're convicted of battery or arson or rape or anything else, you cannot have your financial aid taken away as a result of that conviction.
Good Lord. Okay, now for those who may not know too much about Students for Sensible Drug Policy, you guys have affiliations and campuses all across this country, and you have an event coming up a little bit later this month in Washington, D.C. Tell us about that.
That's correct. Coming up November 17th to the 19th will be the 8th annual SSDP conference. This one is being called Just Say No, KNOW, and this is our first international conference. We're expecting about 25 to 30 students from across Canada to attend this conference. We've got a student coming, I believe, from Russia, perhaps a student or two from Israel. So we're going to have about 250 or so students from across the United States, Canada, and even a few from Europe who are coming to this conference. And these are all students who are concerned with the impact that the war on drugs has on our society, and in particular on our generation as young people. And we're going to have three days of trainings, workshops, and lobbying about various drug policy and activism related issues. Just to break down the conference a little bit for those who are interested, Friday is going to be a congressional lobby day where we're going to spend the morning training the students and non-students about the issues, drug war issues that impact young people, and then sending them to Capitol Hill to meet with their senators and representatives to lobby on behalf of issues that are important to us. On Saturday, we're going to have a day of drug war education where attendees will hear from experts in the drug policy field about various issues in the war on drugs today. And Sunday is going to be a day of activist skills training where attendees will learn skills such as fundraising and media relations and coalition buildings and real activist skills training that will be applicable in their work both in drug policy and beyond.
Once again, we're speaking with Mr. Chris Crane of Students for Sensible Drug Policy. Chris, I find it mind-boggling at times that this drug war supposedly was designed to protect our children. And yet, if they're caught with that little baggie of marijuana, not only do they lose their ability to get government funds for education, but they get that record, that stigma, that influences and in very many ways detracts from their life's potential. Yeah, your thoughts on that?
Well, there's no doubt about it. The war on drugs has been and continues to be a war on young people. It's a war on a number of groups of people. It's certainly a war on people of color. And there's no doubt that it's also a war on young people. If you just look at the statistics of let's take for instance marijuana arrests in this country. If you look at the number of marijuana arrests in this country, we arrest about 800,000 people a year. 90% of those are for simple possession. If you look at the breakdown of those, the majority, or the plurality, I should say, are between the ages of 16 and 29. They're young people. It's young people that are being arrested, and these are people, you know, a lot of times they're you know, these are people in college who are, you know, who are basically making a so-called youthful indiscretion, as the politicians like to call it, and yet they're being saddled with a criminal record that's going to follow them for the rest of their lives. It's going to make it more difficult for them to get jobs in the future. In the case of students who rely on financial aid in order to go to college, they're forced to drop out of college because of a simple, you know, marijuana possession conviction. There's absolutely no doubt that the drug war has targeted young people, and it's really a shame because, you know, from you know, going back to the Reagan Just Say No days in the 1980s, this war has been waged in the name of protecting young people, and it's absolutely failed in protecting young people, and in fact, it's negatively impacted young people. It's negatively impacted our generation. So it's incumbent upon us as young people, as students, to do something about this, to get involved, and to say, you know what, not in our name, no longer. It's up to us to put an end to this, to put an end to this war on drugs once and for all.
Chris, I don't know if it's too late for people to participate, but if folks wanted to learn more about this forthcoming conference, about this, about your organization, Students for Sensible Drug Policy, please point them where they need to go on the web.
Absolutely. Well, it's absolutely not too late to participate. We still are accepting registrations, and we're still accepting scholarship applications for students who need some financial assistance to attend the conference. And if anybody's interested, they can go to ssdp.org/conference, or they can go to schoolsnotprisons.com, and there's a giant conference banner right at the top of the website, schoolsnotprisons.com. So I encourage anybody out there, particularly young people who are interested in finding out a little bit more about both the war on drugs and the student movement to end the war on drugs, to check out the website and to make an effort to come out to the conference. It'll be a great learning experience, and we'll meet some fantastic activists from around the country who are working on this issue on their campuses and in their communities.
Let's talk about the fruit that has grown from the seeds of drug war. The investiture of $100 billion each year to the criminal justice system, the expenditure of $500 billion a year to the terrorist cartels and criminals, the arrest each year of 1.6 million young people in the United States. Every 20 seconds, another young person hears the slamming of that cell door. And yet all of this is based on the presumption that somehow we're saving the children. Meantime, alcohol, tobacco, and pharmaceuticals kill more than 500,000 of us each year. Aspirin and Tylenol kill more of us each year than do all hard drugs combined. A couple of closing notes. I'll be taking 2 3-chip cameras to Bolivia with me. I'm releasing the new first Unvarnished Truth number 1. You can get there by going to our website, which is drugtruth.net. We've got 15 of the 57 minutes available for you to look at online. So who's on this video? John Sinclair, Mason Tavert, Phil Smith, Vivian McPeak, Norm Stamper, Carla Cole, David Gard, Eddie Lepp, Ungayo, Elvie Musica, Steve Cubby, Alan St. Pierre, Sandy Burbank, Randy Rhodes, Ethan Nadelman, Peter Steinbrook, Angel Raich. Send an email to dean@drugtruth.net if you'd like a DVD of it, if you'll put it up on a local access or college channel. We want to educate the public to this travesty, this abomination of drug war. Drugtruth.net. So once again, we close with this thought, that because of prohibition, you don't know what's in that bag. Please be careful.
To the Drug Truth Network listeners around the world, on behalf of engineer Philip Guffey, this is Dean Becker for Cultural Baggage and the Unvarnished Truth. The show produced at the Pacifica Studios of KPFT, Houston.
Tap dancing on the edge of none of this.